You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 41 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
Oh, and we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. And home of a lot of snow right now.
Was I too hot there?
You threw me off a little bit.
It's so cold outside that I had to come in a little bit hotter.
Because not 10 minutes ago, you said you were going to go to sleep.
Yeah, this...
Instead of recording this podcast. So this is a rare edition of the Pelton Cast, where instead of driving over here from my house to record the podcast, I'm just staying here.
It's the Snowpocalypse edition. It's the Pelton Cast sleepover edition.
It is. I have no power at my house currently. Have not all day after getting about 6 inches of snow. You got even a little bit more.
A lot of snow. Tons of snow. And you decided that because your power went out, that you were coming over here and commandeering the TV to watch NBA basketball night.
Fortunately, Baby Fantasy Genius was totally on board with
all
watching Cavs Wizards,
which
was a really fun game to watch.
I was wondering, do you remember any great Seattle sports moments that occurred during the snow?
Well, the Seahawks beat Brett Favre when there was snow on the ground in Brett Favre's. Was that?
I think that was the Jets' year.
Yeah. Okay, so that wasn't his final. No, that was his final year, right?
No, he went to the Vikings.
He went to the Vikings after that? Okay. That would have been his final appearance in Seattle, though. Other great Seattle moments when it was snowy. The Monday Night Football game against the Packers.
That was a big one.
Yeah. In 2006, that was what? Was that Sean Alexander return in that game?
That seems about right. Okay, here's one. There are not a lot of great Sonic snow moments. But do you remember the best Sonic snow moment that happened ever? I don't even think you attended the game. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't.
The year was 1996. No.
The year was 1906.
We drove down to Key Arena. It was at Key Arena, so it had to be 96.
Yeah.
In the snow, driving in Mom's Cadillac.
Yes.
And it was our entire family loaded up into the car.
I attended this game. You remember
who didn't attend the game?
Our dad didn't attend the game.
He didn't attend
the game. He sat in the center house the entire time.
I thought that was you who sat in the center
house. No. What famously happened with me during that game is you guys all moved down to lower seats because obviously there was no one there.
Yes.
It was super snowy.
You're law abiding.
And I refused to move from my chosen seats, from my ticketed seats. And we had to meet up later, which was probably exceedingly difficult. Well, maybe it wasn't because there weren't that many people there, but it could have been exceedingly difficult because we didn't have cell phones.
What happened in that game?
I do not remember anything that happened in that game.
It was against the Spurs. It was in this year that the Spurs were bad before they drafted Tim Duncan.
Correct. It was so when David Robinson and Sean Elliott were injured that entire season. My defining memory of that game, though, is I think finding out at that game, but it was certainly that day that Jason Kidd had been traded to the Phoenix Suns.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You've mentioned repeatedly off air that we have not gone into like the Kevin mental vault of sporty events that happened on random days. This is even a layer deeper because it's not a sporty event on a random day. It's a transaction that happened on a random day.
I'm kind of surprised that you don't remember anything about the game, though. That's what I was getting at, is that you would remember what happened in the game. I think the Sonics won by 50 points.
Yeah, they won very easily. I remember Craig Elo playing in garbage time, and people probably I have a vague recollection of people heckling Craig Elo because that was a really rough season for him.
People did a lot of heckling Craig Elo during that time period.
They did.
Who was the – I think it was Paul – not Paul Silvey.
Oh, Sean Alexander ran for 201 yards on 40 carries in that Monday Night Football game, which was, of course, against the Packers when they had Brett Favre. So if the Seahawks can play Brett Favre in the snow.
There we go.
Unstoppable.
Okay, do you remember we were driving home, and who's the, like, multi-purpose reporter that King 5 had in the 90s? Like, Jim Foreman, I think it was?
That sounds right.
Is that who it was? We were driving along, and he was outside reporting in the snow, and we drove past Jim Foreman.
Wearing one of those yellow coats?
I don't think those existed in 1996.
Oh, that's too bad.
But that was like an important moment for me as an 11-year-old. Was seeing the person that was on TV while we were driving.
I have a very strong memory of something else we haven't talked about ever on the podcast. With the time that I was a Sean Kemp kid.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a great story because Sean Kemp kid. But Reebok back then, it was completely unironically, had a promotion where each game they and the Sonics would choose some kid to be the Sean Kemp kid, and you got tickets. There was a Reebok bag that I used for many years. And then before the game, I got to go down. I think you were there as well.
Yeah.
And we sat on the bench and watched warm-ups, and I took a photo with Sean Kemp that I'll put a link to this in the podcast, in the podcast description and on Twitter, just in case you haven't seen it, because it is one of the most hilarious things. An 11-year-old me, maybe 10, with Sean Kemp, who is several times my size. He is like, the sheer force of his hand on my shoulder is dragging down my sweatshirt. And then I have glasses that are covering approximately 75% of my face.
But I love that they called it Sean Kemp's kids, like, unironically.
I had no idea back then. Because that was before the Sports Illustrated story. That didn't happen until I think Kemp was in Cleveland or maybe his last year in Seattle.
Last year in Seattle that came out.
Okay, so none of us had any idea that that there were so many Kemp kids coming.
Okay, so that game was in the old arena, right?
Yes, that was pre-renovation. That was 1992-93. I didn't circle back to... And sitting next to us on the bench was Los Del Valle.
Oh. That's what you were trying to get to?
Yeah. I don't know if you even remember Carlos Del Valle.
He left when I was pretty young, Carlos Del Valle.
Yeah, he was much more formative in my life.
That was like... We're going to talk a lot about the Sonics on this podcast. Because it's the offseason. It's not NFL offseason. There's not a lot to get to. And I just want to talk about the Sonics.
So weirdly, I'm going back to Basketball Reference. We do not remember that game as well as we thought, because it turns out it was actually a close game against the Spurs.
Really?
It was the day after Christmas, December 26th, Boxing Day.
It was right on Christmas, because a ton of us went down there. Tickets were super cheap.
Yeah. Yeah, we just like all piled into the Cadillac. All the cousins piled in. The Spurs starting lineup in that game.
The heat definitely didn't work in that Cadillac either. It was freezing cold. That leather interior was not good for the snow.
All right, I want to see how many members of the Spurs starting lineup you can name in that game.
Vinny Del Negro.
That is one.
Sean Elliott was out for the year, right?
No, Sean Elliott did play in that game.
Oh, he did play.
David Robinson
was out?
Robinson was out, yes. Okay. He played a handful of games.
So I've got Vinny Del Negro and Sean Elliott?
Yes, you've got two of them.
I should pat myself on the back for getting those two.
I mean, there's one other one that's obvious.
God. Terry Porter?
No, he was not on the team at that point.
Hmm. The other obvious one.
Vernon Maxwell was on the team, though.
What position did the obvious player play?
Point guard.
He's their point guard. Is this like a super famous player?
I mean, he was the point guard on their championship team.
Who was it?
He was a longtime NBA coach.
Oh, Avery Johnson.
That is number three.
Okay. Didn't they have a big man? I'm not going to come up with that one.
Will Perdue.
Oh, wow.
Was starting at center in place of Robinson. And then Carl Herrera was rounding out the starting five.
Nice.
Carl Herrera. Dominique Wilkins came off the bench for a team-high 17 points.
Nice. Okay, so when we had tickets, I want to get back to this. When you were a Kemp kid, it was the closest that we'd ever sat at the time.
That sounds true, yeah.
And right to our left was Sonics guy.
Oh, right. Sonics Jeremy.
His name wasn't Sonics guy at the time?
I don't think so.
Because now they're Sonics guy.
Yes.
But
is he Sonics man? I can never keep straight.
No, he's Sonics guy.
Okay.
His name was Sonics Jeremy.
Yes.
He was more of a fixture of the Coliseum than he was of Key Arena, right?
Yeah, he was only there, I think, like the first year at the Coliseum. Or
but
the Key Arena, I should
say. We didn't have season tickets at that point, and had been to a few Sonics games, but not that many Sonics games.
Yeah, I would say really it was the next year we started going to a lot of games.
And I remember, I think our mom in particular found him obnoxious, because he had the thing that he would twirl around.
It was like a scarf.
Yeah, part of his like jacket or a scarf that he would twirl around. And our mom found it obnoxious, and I think may have thrown a peanut at him.
Really?
Do you remember this?
No, I have no recollection
of
any of this.
I'm still devastated about it to this day.
It's amazing, because you were very young at that point. You were, I think, 7.
It was an important formative moment for me in my life. Apparently to be embarrassed of every single thing that our mom was doing.
And that has continued to this day.
But I just remember like figuring out that this was an important person for the Sonics. Like, for the culture of the team, and that our mom didn't like him and didn't get it, was like, man, who are we as people? I had to really reassess who we were.
At age 7?
Yeah. I had to change my name because of it.
Wow. I was not thinking this deeply in 1989. I don't know. I don't know about you.
Wait, I wanted to say, we should talk about this at some point in the future. With the time that I had to take a half-court shot.
Oh my god, that is such a good story.
Should we save that? Or should I talk about that now? Should we go?
When are we going to come up, bring it up again? Let's just go into it. We don't have much. If you haven't noticed yet, we don't have a lot of regularly scheduled content
really
this week.
You really want to hear about Sounders preseason matches?
I've got some important updates on the Sounders preseason. There, things are happening.
Wait, before I talk about this, let's
crack open these beers.
I am ready to drink this.
So what we have here is the Full Sail iPapaya, in IPA, made with papaya. Wait for it, papaya.
Wow. That is in-depth coverage of this.
Let's see. I don't have the tab open anymore, sadly, where I had information about the...
What were you doing while I was napping pre-podcast?
I closed it because I assumed usually like it says the same thing on the website as it says on the beer. And I'm like, okay, I'll just read it off the beer.
And but it says here, government warning, one according to this... Wait.
Yeah, this one does not have it. A well-balanced, refreshing IPA with a touch of the tropics. Winter weather forecast for Hood River. Unseasonably tropical. That was a bad forecast. iPapaya, the latest in our pub series, blends locally grown hops with notes of papaya for a vacation in a bottle. iPapaya was born out of our interest in the tropical aromas of Northwest hops. Pale and wheat malts, along with healthy additions of Equinox and Cascade hops, provide the perfect golden base for the addition of papaya. The result is a refreshing IPA with a subtle essence of papaya. Tropical aromas of citrus, passion fruit, and papaya are well complemented by clean malt notes.
So they pretty much just made this because they wanted a beer named iPapaya, right?
I'm imagining so. Also, they note that food pairings, it goes well with several Thai dishes, Indian dishes, and light fruit-based
papaya,
desserts.
Perhaps not, no?
They do not specifically mention that, no.
It tastes terrible with papaya. it's not called iPapassion fruit.
It is not, no. We had one of these earlier, since I've been here for a while, and it was pretty good.
Pretty good. It's fine. You can kind of taste the papaya. It's a fine beer. The fact
I mean, I'm more into citrus IPAs than you are. In this, I don't know if papaya is technically
an IPA nowadays.
I don't know if papaya is technically a it's a specific type of beer.
I'm just a little bit skeptical.
I don't think they're like just labeling other types of beers IPA. It's not like when you start putting gluten free on things that obviously don't have
liberal
gluten
definition.
In them. I mean, I don't really know anything about beer. The thing about our beer interest is how beer is made. That's just a mystery to me.
Oh,
like, I just know they're giant bats.
Did you hear Bill and Cousin Sal when Michael Lombardi was saying, he was like, oh, they don't call it the mic. And Cousin Sal's like, what does that mean? I was like, yeah, you can know a lot about something, but not know anything about something.
But I assume that they are brewing it IPA style, just with papaya. They're just brewing a lot of IPAs because IPAs are quite trendy until the sour beer revolution.
Sour beer takes them
over.
You're going to love sour beers.
Hipster
in like
sour
four
beer
years.
Revolution. No, I'm not.
Okay. Well, this is fine. Okay, so really quick, the time that I had to take a half quart shot. So you had asked me, you were working for the Sonics at this point, so there was a little bit of nepotism involved.
More than a little.
I think it's okay to admit because we're about 10 years later. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, and the team does not exist. What are you going to sue the Sonics? Like, okay, go ahead. Sue Clay Bennett. Be my guest.
So there was a contest that was going on. Do you remember this? I think it was 80s night. 90s night.
Yes.
There was a contest that was going on, and you people in the front office clearly were lazy.
What do you mean, you people, first off?
You person? You had nothing to do with this.
I had a very little amount to do with
it. I think that, so there was a contest that happened at 90s night where you were just naming figures. There was a photo of various 90s things. And if you know me, you know that I know a lot about the 90s.
I do.
Right? And I think there were three contestants, and I think two of them were siblings of people who worked at the Sonics.
Yes.
Is that true?
Manager of game operations, his brother was one of the other contestants. I think the third contestant was the only one who was like randomly chosen.
And did not do well.
No.
I think it was close between the two people who were siblings of Sonic's employees. But so there would just be a picture of something from the 90s, right? And then you had to name what it was. And I dominated.
You did.
Do you remember this?
Oh, yeah.
I missed one question the whole time. And I was out of control. It was one of my greatest sports moments, was how good I did at the halftime show, picking things from the 90s, right?
Yeah.
And at no point did Squatch mock me, so that was good. Squatch was the host, naturally.
Yeah.
despite not talking.
It was really like a perfect vehicle for your particular set of skills.
Just recognizing pictures from the 90s.
Like, what is it?
I was like, boom, Debrat! It's like, Boyz II Men!
It's like Liam Neeson and Taken, the particular set of skills. Is that the thing?
Yes. Right? I have no
That's
idea.
That's you at 90s. Well, you're not.
Liam Neeson and Taken, I know nothing about.
Not that set.
Pictures of media from the 90s. You would have talked to me about Naughty by Nature? I got that on lock. Anyway, I missed one question. I still remember it to this day. And it was Beverly Hills 90210, and I think I said Melrose Place. Because I've never seen a single episode of either.
I love that you still answered it. I guess there was no penalty for getting a question wrong.
No, I was buzzing for everything.
It was no Jeopardy.
So I won the contest, and the winning this contest meant that at a later game, I won courtside tickets in the Lazy Boy seats, which were behind the hoop. This all seems really crazy talking about
it. It really does. It
didn't seem that weird at the time.
You just kind of went along with it.
I was probably, 18 years old. No, I remember drinking beer at halftime.
You were
so
older than
I
that.
I was 21.
Yeah, this was probably the second to last season, I would say. Maybe it was either 2005-06 or 2006-07.
Okay, so I was like 22. No, 20. I had to be 21, so I had to be 2006. So we're sitting in seats that are in Lazy Boys behind the hoop.
Yes.
And I had – our mom wanted to go naturally.
Yeah.
And my girlfriend at the time, which is now Mrs. Fantasy Genius.
Yeah.
And so we had to get an extra Lazy Boy. So this is what you can do when you're nepotism winning something. You can request a third Lazy Boy. And so you're sitting behind the hoop. You have courtside access. So at courtside, if you have courtside tickets, there's like a whole meal buffet with free drinks and pretty mediocre food, hot dogs and like soft pretzels and things that you go to at halftime, right?
Yes, the courtside club.
And I remember going back there. This was, I think, maybe the second time that I'd ever been. And Marcus Trufant was back there, who was like a star on the Seahawks at the time.
Yes.
And I was just like, up.
Wait, that's not how I remember you telling this story.
Okay, what is the story? How do you
remember? I remember you telling the story like you guys were loading up on food, like the wealthy people who were in there in the courtside club regularly, like, you know, they're maybe having a thing or two, getting a drink. That's their thing. But you noticed that one other person was in there like stocking up on food, and it was Marcus Trufant. Yeah. And you're like, okay, South End.
I definitely nodded my head, knowingly nodded my head at him.
Oh, a toast to Truth.
Toast to Truth, man. I think still maybe favorite Seahawks players. Truth is in the top three.
That's a different podcast. We've already gone far enough afield on this podcast.
But it's Sean Springs, Marcus Trufant, and Richard Sherman.
So what we're building up to here
is that. So one of your coworkers, I think his name was Brian.
Maybe.
The guy who did the halftime shows, and I remember he had some questionable halftime shows. Do you remember this?
Okay, you're talking about Damien?
Oh, Damien.
Yes.
He comes up to me, and he was like, hey, by the way, you're shooting a half-court shot later. And I'm like, wait, what? And he was like, yeah, that's how we roll. So I think I go out. So I'd been drinking. He came up to me like right before I was about to shoot a half-court shot, which just seems like a thing that you should mentally prepare for.
I agree. Right?
And also not just mentally prepare for, literally prepare for by practicing half-court shots at the school by your house.
Even though the problem is you'd have to figure out where half-court on an NBA hoop corresponds to on the elementary school court you'd be have been playing on.
It would be the other three-point line.
That sounds about right.
Because as you know, I'm good at shooting from far away.
Yes.
Although the school that we played at in like 2005, the court angled down, so it was easier shooting from far away. I don't think that's the case at Key Arena.
That is not actually.
And so Damien
Key Arena has many issues. The court is level.
Came up to me and he was like, "That's how we roll." And I'm like, "Okay." 1 minute later, I'm all of a sudden being introduced at half court. Squatch is there with me, and Squatch attempts one first. Backwards, which as was custom at the time, and Squatch was pretty good. I say this as if Squatch is like an actual, like living, breathing Sasquatch, was pretty good at backwards half court shots. And yes. I think Squatch missed. And then, so I'm trying it. I think I may have psyched myself out a little bit because I had no practice whatsoever.
Yes.
And I step up. I'm like, all right. F it, I'm doing this. This was to win like
what else was $25,000
to Lazy Boy or something.
What was the alternative? You were just gonna like hand the ball to Squatch and be like, nah, I'm good.
It's just like, all right, this is what's happening. I drank a lot at halftime, I toasted with Marcus Trufant, I'm good. And I step up, I run into the half court shot. I do it overhand, right?
Yeah.
As you would do. Basically just a shot from far away, Steph Curry range, who I'd never heard of at the time. And throw it up, it's like dead on. And like 3 feet to the right.
Yeah. And it's weird. You got made fun of more for it being like 3 feet to the right than you would have for it being 3 feet short.
That's crazy. Squatch kept making fun of me. I remember there were boos. I'm pretty sure I got booed. Do you remember what you told me after that?
No.
You told me that you, because where I think you sat on the sides.
And I thought it was going in.
You thought it looked good.
Yeah, no, I was sitting at the top of the bowl because I would have been doing stats for David Locke.
And then we were at the season ticket holder party. I think there were boos from the crowd for airballing. It's like, come on. I had the distance. That's all that matters. The distance is what matters in the situation.
I don't know. They agree. That's all that matters.
God, nobody else in the crowd didn't know that they were taking a half court shot as of 2 minutes beforehand. And then we were at the season ticket holder party a couple months later, and Squatch made fun of me again.
I forgot about that part. Can I tell you my... I'm sure I've told you this many years ago, but my story of the time I was on court during a timeout.
No, when was this?
This was at a Seattle Storm game when I was...
Oh, I do remember this. I think I was there.
Right after I had been hired full-time, so it was 2004, the season the Storm went on to win the championship. And at that point, like, I hadn't done any events as, like, an employee of the Storm, so they could use me as a plant in an on-court skit. And so what they did is, in that one, we had gone there that afternoon at Tiki Arena and taped something where Doppler locked me outside of Key Arena is an LA Sparks fan, a fan of the rival LA Sparks.
Named what?
Hmm?
Were you going to say what your name was?
Oh, I don't remember.
Oh, you said an LA Sparks fan name. I was like, wow, you really embodied that character. You're like, what if I was born and raised as an LA Sparks fan?
So we had this all taped and ready to go. And then during the game, I put on a Sparks jersey and came out to center court. And it was a thing where one of those things where you're blindfolded and they try to, you know, the fans are supposed to direct you where to go. And so the fans were supposed to direct me towards the exit, like was the idea, away from Squatch, or Doppler rather, the Storm mascot, who was then going to lock me out. But I was legitimately blindfolded. Like, I actually couldn't see. And then when I get out there, like, the fans aren't in on the joke. They don't know what they're supposed to do. So they're just sending me random directions. I just wandered all over the court for a whole time out. And then they finally, like, pulled me off and were like... And so it ended up being pretty funny, but it wasn't at all what was actually planned.
Did
we never got to
clip?
No,
the clip
never got aired.
Unseen. Wow, Kevin Pelton. Unseen Seattle Storm clip with Doppler.
I don't think those archives exist anymore, but if they do, it's somewhere in those archives. The other story I was going to tell, by the way, is my half-court shooting prowess. I once went when the Storm moved into Furtado Center, the Sonics and Storm practice facility, used it briefly as our office after the Sonics moved. We had a half-court shooting competition on the practice court that I won.
Wait, really?
Yeah, and Karen Bryant... still owes me $50.
Does she?
Yeah.
She owes me a lot, too. You tell her if you ever see her.
Yeah, I will. Bring that up. Be sure to bring that up.
She owes me some severance pay. You won the half court contest?
I mean, it was just whoever made one first. It was pretty random.
Were the players
participating
or just
staff? No, it was just staff. Nice. This was well after the season.
A toast to you.
Yeah, thanks. And to your 90s trivia knowledge, good sir.
I mean, I'm still frustrated. I wish I had another crack at that half-court shot. This is like, these are the weird things. This is what happened when you were a fan of a team where they didn't have that many fans. Like, this whole situation seemed totally reasonable to me at the time. We would occasionally get courtside tickets, too. Like, we had courtside tickets two or three times around that time period.
It's funny. I was thinking last Saturday during the UW basketball game, like... whatever shooting competition they were having, or maybe this was a game I was watching on TV, and I was like, man, I'm glad that as a member of the media I can never be chosen for this again, because I know how anxious I would be and would just do terribly.
That was the good thing about it happening right away, though, is I didn't have any time to psych myself out. I was able to enjoy the game sitting in a Lazy Boy for the first half of that Detroit Pistons game in a Lazy Boy.
The other time I was on court, this was during halftime at a UW basketball game my freshman year when I was sitting in the student section, and it was like I forget exactly what kind of game it was, but basically you opened a package and then someone else could steal. It was basically a white elephant, whatever that Christmas gift exchange kind of thing is, except there was only like three of us. And I unwrapped like a Madden computer game for that year, but then someone else stole it, and the thing I opened ended up being like this giant box that only had a pom-pom in it.
Well, yeah, obviously the giant box is going to have the worst prize.
Oh, yeah. But that was like a really bad prize relative to everything else. All I got out of it was like a t-shirt.
I think a Madden computer game seemed like a really cool thing to us at the time.
I mean, that's, you know, a lot more valuable than a pom-pom. I would have played that Madden game.
Anyway, I've been missing just having general, just like the slog of being an NBA fan lately. A lot more than I ever thought that I would.
Yeah.
So to transition abruptly, this is the point where I might be talking about this week's burger from Lil Woody's. This week's burger of the week.
Yes.
I might be talking about my hat that I'm going to be wearing. If not, I didn't make it and we didn't record this because you forced me to record this podcast on a Monday, although things are going pretty well so far.
They are, yes. I think it was a good decision to do it. But yeah, you have, because of the fact that you worked from home today due to the snow, obviously not had a chance to enjoy this week's Lil Woody's Burger of the Week during Burger Month.
So anyway, that's my impression of this week's Burger of the Week.
I think it's also possible that we will not record something subsequently, and we'll just post your thoughts on the Sonic Central Pelton Cast blog post about this. And so if you don't hear anything, go check that out.
Well, those thoughts are either very positive or very negative, and I believe in them strongly. Speaking of believing in things strongly, though, the Atlanta Falcons in the Super Bowl.
Man, it looked so good. It looked so good, and then it didn't.
I'm gonna say something a little bit crazy. I'm like 10% as upset today as I was after the Seahawks-Patriots Super Bowl.
That's interesting. I feel like I've moved on pretty quickly. Now, maybe that was partially because like I didn't have to sit and watch the Patriots celebrate because they immediately ran into my car.
To TV. I was like, you want to watch Tumbleleaf? Boom, we are into it.
I immediately raced home, driving home so I could avoid the snow that was starting to stick at that point.
Hope that you died along the way. without having to see the Patriots celebrate another goddamn Super Bowl.
There was a second I was like, wait, should I turn on the radio coverage of this? And I was like, no, obviously I shouldn't. Actually,
good.
Keep listening to this podcast I'm listening to.
Everything about it was bad. There was really like the comeback story. I really like comebacks, right? And I like close football games.
That's weird. I kind of hate comebacks.
Do you?
Yeah.
Well, comebacks almost always mean the team who is favored comes back to win. There's almost no situation. The Clemson coming back against Alabama, that was what I was thinking about during this game, was like when Clemson came back against Alabama, that's kind of what it reminded me of. But it was flipped. It was as if Alabama would have come back against Clemson.
Right.
It was the team that we didn't want to have win, the kind of insurmountable force doing what everybody expected them to do.
I mean, to me, the big thing is that, and I mentioned this to you yesterday during the game, like the way that game played out reinforced a lot of opinions about football that are generally not supported by the larger body of statistical evidence. So the idea of momentum, that New England got on a roll in the second half and just couldn't be stopped, or, you know, it's okay to play for the field goal down 19 because of the fact that you'll probably get 2 2-point conversions and it is a two-score game down 16 points. All of those things kind of played out the way they did. Although on the other hand, the whole idea of establishing the run seems pretty meaningless after Tom Brady threw 63 passes in a Super Bowl win.
Well, so there are a couple things that I saw today where it's like, there was something about Bill Barnwell tweeting about like, oh, my preview didn't look that bad because the score is 34-28 with a pick six. And you're just like, why are you even considering this? Like this is not the way that the game went. Any person who went into the game predicting that the Patriots would like dominate the game and win comfortably by a touchdown. That's not the way that the game went. You can't make a story that that was the case.
How do you feel like our analysis held up? Because we talked about this during the third quarter when Atlanta was dominating, and you felt pretty good about what you had said about the Falcons.
Okay, I mean, this is I'm going to kind of answer that question, but also say what I was going to say.
Okay.
Which is, it felt too much like a Seahawks game.
It felt so
much. We let them off the hook. It was like, this was the Bengals game that we'd seen last year. Why aren't you running the ball, Falcons? There's so many things where it's like, what are you doing right now?
Snapping the ball with 20 on the play clock.
Ugh! There were so many stupid little mistakes that they made.
I mean, I did think, I think the notion that once they got to the 20 with on that Julio Jones catch, that like they should have just ran it three times and kicked the field goal.
Yes, for sure, 100%.
No, I think that's completely wrong, because I think you should not assume the field goal is going to be made in that situation. We've talked about the reasons why extra points might be more difficult than field goals from that same location, but that's the same location distance, more or less, is the extra point. And the extra point is by no means automatic.
So frustrated that Stephen Gostkowski missed extra point didn't matter at all. Also, nobody even remembers that that happened.
No, I vaguely remember it at best. So I think that that was, that idea is overly conservative, and that it's just hindsight bias based on what ended up happening. Like, the odds of that sequence playing out like it did are infinitesimally low.
Okay, so you asked about how our analysis held up.
Yes.
Which, at least my general analysis was, with this Falcons offense, they're going to score, and you need to score to keep up with them. And it's such a hard thing to do.
Yes.
And then the Falcons just didn't score. I mean, they just stopped scoring in the second half. They were so close. I still don't think that the Patriots defense is that good. I think the Patriots defense will end up going down as very overrated, and a couple of very unlikely, of low percentage things to happen, happened.
I don't know that it'll go down as very overrated. They won the Super Bowl, so history, victors tend to write the history.
Okay, they won the Super Bowl because of their offense.
I don't disagree.
Did not win the
but I'm saying
Bowl.
That when people look back on them, they're like, Patriots defense, very overrated.
It's not going to go down as anything. Nobody's going to talk about their defense.
They did come up with a lot of sacks, to their credit. And that, I think, was one of the big surprises of this game, was how effective both pass rushes were.
Basically, what we talked about happened, and what everybody else talked about happened too, because there were two different games.
Yes.
There was the situation which was the Falcons had open receivers everywhere. Like, we saw the Falcons of the Packers game and the Seahawks game, and then it just stopped. Like, you can't even really pinpoint. I mean, you can pinpoint the exact moment, but you can't pinpoint why.
Well, the reason why is probably mostly randomness. I mean, how many?
They ran the ball, I believe, three times in the second half.
But what are we really talking about here? Like, up to that Julio Jones catch, they were continuing to move the ball in the second
but
half.
But they didn't run the ball after that. They did not run the ball after that, and they were running the ball well. They went into the game expecting to run the ball. First play, boom, Devontae Freeman.
I mean, I think
open.
There's a big difference between running the ball in a neutral situation where New England is having
and
to worry about
the ball
your multiple.
When you're up at the end of the game?
Yeah, that's a lot more difficult task because the defense knows
a
run is coming.
You at least do it more time. Look, I mean, you agree that Kyle Shanahan or Dan Quinn or whomever managed plays and the game clock badly.
No, I don't agree. I think that's hindsight bias.
Oh my God. You don't agree with that? I was saying it at the time. We all saw it.
Yeah, you saw it. I mean, first off,
are you running a play with 20 seconds left?
That is inexcusable.
They didn't play the game as if they were about to win it.
I have no defense for the way they managed the play clock. But the play selection, I don't have a big issue with that.
They passed way too much at the end of the game. They ran the ball well. Devontae Freeman ran the ball well. Tevin
Coleman
ran the ball well.
There's a difference between running the ball well when New England has multiple defensive backs on the field, has, you know, seven in the box instead of eight in the box. That's a different situation. It's really hard to run the ball against a defense that knows you're going to run the ball. Also, the runs that there
isn't working, but I wanted to look up where the Falcons rank.
Also,
as a rushing team,
the successful runs the Falcons had early in this game were almost exclusively to the edge,
yes,
which are higher risk plays. If you're going to run the ball late in the game because all you're trying to do is like 1 yard in a cloud of dust, I guess, and
they don't need to do that. You can still run the ball to the edge. The clock still stops. It still counts as a running play.
The clock still runs. I think is what you were trying
to
say.
The clock doesn't stop. I don't. You're just wrong about this. It's really weird, though, that how personally I'm taking it. That I mean, partially because there's so many factors in this game, but just that this felt so much like a Seahawks team.
It did.
You know? I really think that's the issue. People were like, oh, wow, Patriots really trolled the Seahawks with their play calling at the goal line. It's like, they weren't thinking about the goddamn Seahawks from 2 years ago at the goal line. They were trying to win the game. People don't... Play callers don't troll other teams in these situations. It's like,
they only troll other teams in when they have Dontari Poe play quarterback on a two-point conversion late in a blowout game. Then they legitimately are trolling. But yes, you're absolutely right here.
I liked, you see Marshawn Lynch tweeting, he's like, now I understand why I didn't get the ball at the one. Which I think he was trying to say, like, Dan Quinn just doesn't believe in running the ball. Like it was some sort of case.
I don't know
what he was trying to say, but I still agree with him. Whatever it was, he was right. Should we talk about other Seahawks stuff?
Well, do we want to talk about, does the way this game played out make you feel any differently about the Seahawks' loss to the Falcons? Because when during the third quarter, we were rationalizing that loss so hard.
God, there was so much rationalizing. I mean, no, not really. The thing is,
We did learn that even, I mean, look, the Patriots defense, yes, not very good over the course of the season, et cetera, but much improved and better over the course of the season than the Seahawks defense was without Earl Thomas. The fact that they had such difficulty stopping the Falcons for 3+ quarters, whatever length of time you want to say, that to me does say we might have overreacted a little bit to the Seahawks defense against the Falcons.
Let me tell you a little bit of something about rationalizing.
Yeah.
You can rationalize both ways.
Oh.
Because the Seahawks were the only team to beat Tom Brady on the Patriots.
A toast to that.
So we can rationalize that way. Look, this doesn't change anything. The Seahawks didn't participate in the game. They didn't matter. That's it.
I suppose that's true.
We shouldn't feel anything about the Seahawks, but we should think about the Seahawks for next year. And that's why immediately after the game, odds were released for next year's Super Bowl.
Yes, and the Seahawks coming... I don't know, I've seen multiple conflicting reports on where the Seahawks odds actually were for next season.
Seems like you could find the source information. Well,
so I got the immediate email after the game. They sent this to all of the people with ESPN addresses from RJ Bell, which had the Seahawks at 15-1.
I saw 10-1,
which was at that point the fifth best odds behind the Patriots at 7-1, Falcons 12-1, Falcons, Cowboys, and Packers all at 12-1. And yeah, I've seen different reporting on it, so it may depend on the house at this point, and then it may have changed based on immediate returns.
Did you have some thoughts on it?
It seems crazy to me that the Seahawks would be behind other teams in the NFC. That seems to me to be...
What?
You don't think they're in the same tier as the Packers?
I mean, I guess so.
You don't think...
But it seems crazy to you that they'd be behind the Falcons, who just probably should have won the Super Bowl?
Yeah, they had a great season, but when you're predicting what's going to happen in 2017, you have to look at multiple previous seasons, not just the most recent one.
Okay, yes, I agree. See, the thing is...
Which is why the Falcons had really low Super Bowl odds, lower than they probably should have been last year, although their two seasons ago was not very good either, but that's neither here
nor
there.
People are incorrectly judging the Seahawks based upon Earl Thomas being injured.
And I think this ongoing narrative of Seahawks decline, which, again, yes, obviously they were not as good last year as they were in previous seasons. But you know what's part of the reason they weren't as good as previous seasons? Because in each of the previous four seasons, they were the best team by DVOA. You can't get any better than that.
There we go. We're back, baby. We are coming back. The slate is clear. Here we go. 2017 season DVOA championship is ours.
I mean, I'm not saying that the Seahawks should be up there with the Patriots.
I don't know who won the DVOA championship this year. I'm guessing the Patriots.
Yeah, I haven't looked at that. I mean, they don't. I don't know whether you count it strictly through the regular season or not.
We own that. We own the DVOA championship.
It's coming back to its rightful home. I also saw the lines that Bill Simmons quoted on his podcast today, like, had the Seahawks and the Raiders with the same odds. And, like, come on, guys. Like, they had a great year and all, but come on.
I like the Raiders. I really
you think they have the same odds of winning the Super Bowl as the Seahawks?
I just could not care less about what the odds are for the Seahawks. I would rather the Seahawks be underdogs. I don't want people to see us coming.
I tend to agree with that, but I'm just saying from a rational standpoint, it seems like the Seahawks are too low.
Sure. Okay, great. Like, I guess we need something to complain about as Seahawks fans.
You brought the topic up.
You told me you wanted to talk about it. You said, quote, I have thoughts.
I had thoughts.
I was just setting you up. Anyway. So, speaking of next season, something that's setting the Seahawks up for next season, it looks like, per an NFL.com report.
Yeah, Ian Rappaport with that report, I believe on Super Bowl Sunday, yes, that the Seahawks will not be penalized for the Richard Sherman injury non-disclosure, which seems appropriate given that immediately after that initial report that they might be penalized, there were reports that like half a dozen other teams didn't disclose injuries. The Colts with Andrew Luck, the Steelers with Le'Veon Bell.
Were these reports or are these people on Twitter talking on it?
No, I think these were legitimate reports. I mean, the Colts had been the previous season, but and then even the Falcons with Alex Mack, no one knew until Super Bowl Sunday that he had a broken fibula, which seems like a relevant thing.
It was ridiculous. They're like trying to put the Seahawks on notice.
Yes,
it was ridiculous. So sometimes when you're winning forever can mean a lot of things, right? Winning forever can mean defending your guys.
Yes. And I think that Pete Carroll pretty clearly exaggerated in Richard Sherman's defense because he was able to play in the Pro Bowl, which is a meaningless game at the end of the season.
Yeah. A game that many like totally healthy players do not participate
in. Tom Brady hasn't played in since, I believe, like 1997, and he wasn't even in the NFL
That's
yet.
Because he's
that
the
point.
Worst, and he's an elitist, and would not sink to playing in the Pro Bowl with the working-class NFL players.
Also because he's been in like 7 Super Bowls in that span, but that's neither here nor there.
And then probably the biggest news for the Seahawks this last week.
Yeah. A toast, I think, is in order here to Seahawks legendary Seahawks safety Kenny Easley, who has been selected by
grabbing another iPapaya for this toast,
is a veterans candidate for the Hall of Fame. So he becomes, I think it was the fourth like career Seahawk to make the Hall of Fame.
Who got ahead of him? Tez?
Walt Jones. And
Big Walt.
And Steve Largent.
Steve Largent.
So those three guys played their entire career for the Seahawks.
Kenny Easley played on another team?
Well, he got traded. I can't remember now off the top of my head.
You don't know this info, which is fine, because Kenny Easley played his entire career before we were born.
That is not true. But yes, I feel like I should be probably more excited about this than I am, but because of the fact that Kenny Easley retired... He retired after that trade because of his kidney issues.
So he didn't play for any other team.
He did not, but he retired in 1987. I was age 5 his last season.
Wait,
you
so
were age
every
2.
Single Seahawks Hall of Famer has played every single game.
Well, no, Jerry Rice is a Hall of Famer. Franco Harris played for the Seahawks at the end of his career.
NFL players don't really go in with a specific team in the same way that baseball players do.
No, but I mean, among the players that you would like associate with the Seahawks, yeah, they all played their entire career in Seattle.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, definitely a toast to Kenny Easley.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I really couldn't even name the greatest Kenny Easley plays.
Yeah. I mean...
That long pause is because you can't either?
No.
Look, if you would have played basketball in the snow in 1995, you'd remember everything about it, or maybe been traded in 1995 to the Phoenix Suns or something.
I mean, all we can go by is kind of the legends and, you know... The greatest safeties of the game tend to talk about how great Kenny Easley was.
Yeah.
So, kudos to him.
I have so little to add about Kenny Easley.
I feel like we need to come up with like an 80s Seahawks expert to talk about Kenny Easley when the Hall of Fame game rolls around and when he gets inducted next in August. But I don't know who that would be because all Seahawks fans are the same age as us.
Yep. No. They're slightly younger than you are.
That's true. I'm the old man of Seahawks Twitter.
Big news for the Sounders this week. So you tell me.
So the Sounders had their opening preseason match last week in Tucson against the Portland Timbers, a 1-1 draw.
Ugh, But those the hated Timbers.
Most notable thing here, Clint Dempsey getting the start in his first game action since the irregular heartbeat forced him off the field midway through last season. He played 30 minutes, and after the match, manager Brian Schmetzer said his recovery is, quote, going as scheduled. So I think all indications that he'll continue to be he'll be a key part of the Sounders this season.
So we've talked about this a little bit, but what is the formation going to look like when you have both Ladero and Clint Dempsey?
Yeah, and we did not get a look at the full Sounders in this match because of the fact that Jordan...
It was a completely meaningless game in February.
No, because Jordan Morris is busy with the U.S. national team, and we'll talk more on that in a second here. Okay. But the formation they started, they put Will Bruin, who is newly acquired from Houston.
Who you've definitely never heard of.
I've heard of him before. I've read some stuff about him on SoundersFC.com.
That was more for the listener.
I could not pick him out of a lineup. But he's kind of like a target forward, which the Sounders haven't really had in a while. I don't know if I can think of who the last one was. Like Nate Jaquia in the early years was that kind of classic target forward. But he played as the single forward, and then they played three attacking midfielders, put Dempsey in the center, and then put Ladero on the right wing to kind of cut in on his dominant left foot from the right wing.
Who's the third one?
I do not remember who they started at the left midfielder at the top of my head, but that will obviously be Jordan Morris's spot.
Oh, Jordan Morris. Is Will Bruin going to start?
I think so.
Really?
That's the sense I get.
Jordan Morris is not going to be the striker. He's going to be playing attacking mid.
Well, and maybe the formation changes a little bit when Morris is on the field, but you know, we'll see. We'll find out. This is all kind of the experimentation process. But
I'm that
4-2-3-1 formation with the two defensive midfielders set is Alonso and Roldan, and then three attacking midfielders seems to be what Schmetzer has favored. He's stuck pretty consistently with that since he took over.
What about 4-2-2-2?
Could be. I don't know. We'll see.
Because you've got...
And, I mean, there are variations of these things. Like,
yes.
You know, Morris can play further advanced than the other attacking midfielders because of the fact that he's more of the traditional forward.
But if you have your defenders, you've got Roldan and Alonso. I like Alonso in the middle of the field.
Yeah.
Which, granted, you could play in the numbers don't really matter. You could play in the middle of the field wherever you want.
Yes.
But, and then Ladero and Dempsey, and then Will Bruin, who I've never heard of, and Jordan Morris.
And Bruin may not end up starting, but, I mean, he's such a talented...
And you have to have Svensson in there.
Such a talented... I don't think Svensson's going to start. I think he's depth
really?
At that central defense.
Was Svensson a designated player, or is he just European?
I don't think he's a designated player. If he is, I have not seen that reporting.
Okay.
The other notable thing from that game, Stefan Fry sat out, still dealing with the minor injury. He suffered training with the USMNT. And backup Tyler Miller went the full 90 minutes and was very strong in goal. Had a save that apparently was reminiscent of Fry's save in the MLS Cup.
That's a huge play.
Equally important.
Why are we talking about Sounders preseason?
Sounders preseason continues tomorrow, Tuesday, with a scrimmage.
The most thorough coverage of Sounders preseason that we have ever done.
Undeniably. A scrimmage against San Jose. I mean, they've never been the defending champs
this
going
is like
into preseason.
They're winning. That Stefan Fry save that he had meant that we're talking about this right now.
Yes, that was its main draw. Speaking of the USMNT and our good friend Jordan Morris, he scored the winning goal as they beat Jamaica 1-0 in Chattanooga.
Huge.
Friday in a friendly.
Big win. Yeah. You don't come into Chattanooga and beat the USMNT.
In a regular sized field that they crammed in there. It still had the football lines the yard markers on there quite visibly on TV.
What is the Chattanooga's team's lookouts?
The Mox. I feel like that's maybe a minor league baseball team. Anyway, Brad Evans came on as a substitute at right back for Graham Zusi, who is there experimenting with him. Bruce Arena is experimenting with him playing right back now. And Chad Marshall, after starting the previous friendly, did not play in this one.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Any other Sounders news?
No, that would about cover it.
Can we briefly talk Husky basketball? Husky men's basketball? Oh, it's a Kevin sigh. You don't get those too often.
That's like a double sigh. I don't know, man. Saturday night was rough. It was rough. I believe you said on Saturday afternoon that you thought that Lorenzo Robar was going to pull some magic out and beat UCLA?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that didn't happen.
I don't think that happened. You do not have that recorded.
Yeah, it's true. It was outside of a game, so I'm allowed to quote it on here. The Huskies lost 107-66 to UCLA. It was exactly as close as the score indicated. The UW defense, their only defense was UCLA randomly missing a bunch of open threes in the first half. And that regressed to the mean hard after halftime.
Their only defense, in a game that was close, they missed a bunch of threes. Or in a game that was a 40-point victory.
Yeah. I mean, there was the gambler's fallacy in the second half. It ended up evening out their three-point shooting. But yeah, I mean, at this point, I think it's become pretty clear that the Huskies shooting during the first half, during non-conference play, I should say, was somewhat fluky and not representative of their actual shooting ability. And as a result, their defense has been like maybe marginally better than it was in non-conference play.
No, it hasn't.
I mean, there's other teams giving up more points per possession than the Huskies
there
are.
There can't be.
No, it's true. It's true. I have the stats to prove
it. I've determined that if like you and me and three guys who are willing to pass the ball would go out there and just pass the ball around, we could get an open layup every single time against the Huskies.
That is not true. That's not that bad. Colorado is allowing an equivalent number of points per possession.
Half court shots, we're pretty good.
That's we've heard that. Wazoo and Oregon State, so they're both averaging 1.13 points per possession. Wazoo and Oregon State are allowing 1.18 points per 100 possessions. Wazoo's getting outscored by as much as UW per game, and yet it has twice as many victories in Pac-12 play, and I don't understand that whatsoever.
From 1-2?
No, they're 2-4. They have 4. But the Husky offense now better in conference play only than, again, Oregon State, who is 0-11 and one of the worst teams in major conference basketball, and then Stanford. They're scoring 0.99 points per possession, Stanford at 0.97.
So two questions. Tell us about Colorado and Utah this week. And also, who do you think should be the Huskies' next coach?
I mean, there's really not too much to say about Colorado and Utah. The Huskies had the comeback win to beat the Buffaloes at home, but going to be a lot different at altitude in both of these games, and then lost badly to Utah and have no reason to expect they'll be more competitive. I mean, I think the one thing we've taken away from the 11 games the Huskies have played in Pac-12 play so far is, like, they're really bad against really good offenses. Like, it's not linear, it's exponential. So against Oregon, against UCLA, against Utah even, who shoots a really high percentage, as we talked about on that preview, it's going to get extremely ugly.
Okay, so you're saying that this weekend will get extremely ugly at one point?
Yes.
Right around Saturday?
Yes.
Great.
So the Huskies are almost certainly going to lose both games. They will drop to 2-11 in conference play.
Oh my God.
And have lost, I believe, 7 consecutive games at this point. Saturday was the worst loss of the Romar era. I mean, I think the one thing that needs to be reminded people is, like, it used to be, like, not that notable when they lost by 40 points.
That was a long time ago.
It happened a lot under Bob Bender. That's one thing I used to try to...
a very long time ago, though.
Yeah, because Lorenzo Romar has been here a long time, much longer than
slow
most
clap,
coaches.
Slow clap for him.
And
Very nice.
I think sometimes people forget.
Very nice that he set the standard above being disappointed when you lose by 40 points.
Sometimes people forget how bad this program was before Lorenzo Romar and how bad it might be after him. So I would say just the future is
bleak. I heard the next coach, they might even be 2-11 in conference play.
The future is bleak.
I mean, it's bad. It's bad always.
Yep.
But stay tuned for our breaking podcast for Lorenzo Romar's firing in March.
It's just gonna be a podcast of reliving the good times with Romar.
It's
gonna be our podcast.
All rationalization.
No, there's no.
There's nothing to rationalize at that point.
Yeah.
I'll be like, and Michael Porter has just announced that he's not coming, and that he's committed to Missouri.
I'm so prepared for that scenario, and I'm gonna be such a big Mizzou fan.
I can't wait for the impassioned plea for Brandon Roy to be that coach, though. That's all I care about.
Or Michael Porter Sr.
I'm telling you, that's the answer. That's the answer right there. B-Roy's ready. I've seen him coach. He doesn't do a lot, but he's ready. Like, you said it was going to be bleak. At least we have Michael Porter. Look, if you're a high school player who's going to commit to a college, wouldn't you commit to B-Roy?
So why is B-Roy taking over for his coach again?
When opportunity knocks.
And why is Michael Porter Sr. staying with, like, his best friend got fired? Like, someone explain this to me. Break this down for me.
He wants to be an assistant on B-Roy's staff to see what's going on.
Sure.
He recognizes potential.
Okay. You say so. In better news.
What about the Husky women? Yeah.
You know, women's basketball, a sweep of these same mountain schools. Is that what you call Utah and Colorado?
The Husky's a good volleyball school also. Can we start talking about that?
It's still a long ways till volleyball season, but I bet softball is starting before too long.
Hello.
There you go. An 82-53 win at Utah on Friday and a 79-75 win at Colorado on Sunday. Held on in that one after leading most of the way. Huskies holding strong, steady at number 10 in both the AP and coaches poll, as well as the NCAA selection committee's latest update on their seed, the S-curve for seeding for the NCAA tournament.
So sitting in number 3 seed, going to host first round games here in Seattle, and feeling pretty good that they're going to be there.
So a couple of interesting results from the Pac-12 women this week. Number one, UCLA went into lost at Cal.
Okay.
So now they are two games back of the Huskies in the standings. So, I don't know. I might have that right. I think they're tied now, or they're one game back in the standings, but they still would have the lead potential. Okay. They'd still be tied if UW still has to play at UCLA. So they need the Bruins to lose again to be in a situation where they could lose
twice
at UCLA. This is me trying to remember the standings off the top of my head. They still would have to lose again for the Huskies to be able to lose at UCLA and still know that automatically they're going to have the upper hand in that for a third in the conference. But also, UCLA went into Stanford and beat the Cardinal, who now have two losses on the season. So the door cracked open a little bit for the Huskies to finish in the top two. Again, because Stanford has that tiebreaker, they need the Cardinal to lose again.
What a volatile weekend for UCLA.
Yeah, really, really unpredictable. You thought they were going to go 1-1 in the Bay Area. You did not expect it was going to happen.
You know,
when
I project UCLA's trip to the Bay Area in women's basketball, I was like 1-1. I mean, obviously.
So coming up this weekend for the UW women,
who's that?
Friday they host Arizona, and it's the return of assistant coach and Seattle Storm legend Adia Barnes.
Oh, really?
He's now the head coach at Arizona.
You're not gonna name drop here how good of friends you are with Adia Barnes?
My good friend Adia Barnes.
Okay. Good. There we go.
Yeah. And then on Sunday they host Arizona State, one of the challengers in the Pac-12. So that'll be a notable game.
Is Adia Barnes still the head coach of Arizona?
Yeah.
Oh, well, look at her.
Yeah. And like the Dohertys at UW, her husband is her assistant coach, so they've got that,
really?
That setup going.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, getting her family paid. Mm-hmm. how long have we talked for?
An hour here.
Really?
Yeah. 57 minutes.
Good God. So
we talked a long time about shooting half-court shots.
It was worth it.
It was all worth it.
Speaking of half-court shots, I want to talk for 1 second. So, because we didn't have a lot of time during football season, and that was when George Carl's book, which is called
Furious George.
Okay, that seems about right.
Yeah. I don't know the
Curious George pun, though, really?
Let me find the whole subtitle, because the subtitle really tells you about this book. And why, like, when I saw it on Amazon, I was like, oh, this is going to be something. I did not expect it was going to be what it was, but I knew it was going to be something.
Furious George. George Carl talks shit about every single person that he's come in contact with for the last 40 years.
My 40 years surviving NBA divas, clueless GMs, and poor shot selection.
Pretty much.
Yeah. The clueless GMs didn't get a lot of attention, as it turned out.
He ignored the clueless GMs. Or they were in the book, but they didn't get a lot of... People were fine. So I want to talk about... Because I haven't read this book. I'm assuming most people haven't, you know? For self-preservation.
But, for self-preservation? Like, you're going to be tainted if you read the book?
Maybe.
Are you saying that I'm tainted?
A little bit. No, no, just not having to read the words of George Carl. I would much rather hear these stories over whiskey and water at Mecca Cafe.
I agree with that. It'd probably be more likely be a couple of, I forget what he says his beer of choice is there. High Life, maybe?
Miller High Life?
Something like that.
Okay, let me tell you the play. You go to Mecca, which is where George Carl drinks, right? Well, drank during the 90s.
There was a story from like a former Mecca bartender, and I want to say the Weekly might have been The Stranger, at some point when he retired, and he was like talking about famous patrons, and George Carl was among that list, yes.
You get... a shot of Maker's Mark or whatever. I'm assuming Jameson for George Carl. One of the two.
I don't think that George Carl's a big shot guy.
It's not a shot. You sip it.
Okay.
You don't take it as a shot.
I think he just likes drinking beer, which he talks about in the book that he liked to order two at a time because he assumed he could drink them twice as fast as the waiter or waitress would come back to take his order.
Wow. I'm right there with you, George.
Respect.
But it's always a shot of beer, right? That's what you drink. You get the shot of Maker's Mark or Jameson. You go high with the liquor with the shot, and you go low with the beer, and you get the high life.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the play at Mecca, because Mecca's a drinking bar, right? Those shots are not a normal shot. That's a big shot for you. And George Carl would have liked to have hung out there. Unfortunately, his time at being the head coach of the Seattle Supersonics didn't overlap with my time at the Vera Project.
Sadly, no. Yeah, just a few years off. But one of the things he says in the book, and I don't know if you're explicitly alluding to this or not.
No, I'm not at all. I literally know nothing about it.
He wanted the book to be like he was talking to you at a bar, like you were a stranger at a bar, and you were asking him, hey, so what's it like to coach in the NBA? And
do you have any racist thoughts about NBA players? No. Wait, no. But so then I want to hear about, because I literally have not heard anything about this book as it pertains to the Sonics. All I've heard about is Kenyon Martin and
Carmelo Anthony. Yeah, no, was there anything else that was particularly controversial? I guess that was the main stuff.
I mean, talking bad about every single person, like superstars that he like practiced with, met one time, ran into it at an airport.
I mean, I think the Sonic story that I saw get aggregated, now that we live in this aggregation world, was Carl relating the story of the Sonics almost trading for Scottie Pippen at the 1994 NBA draft.
Okay.
Which is a story that is pretty well known, I think, among Sonics fans, that they nearly traded Kemp for Pippen. They would have also thrown in their first round pick that year, which was number 10, thanks to the Dana Barros trade. They had a lottery pick that year.
Who did that end up being?
It ended up being, I want to say, Carlos Rogers.
Okay. Complete waste of a pick.
No one of note.
He was the 10th pick in the draft, Carlos Rogers?
I believe that was the case.
It wasn't Doug Christie who was eventually traded for Sam Perkins.
No, that was much earlier. So the notable thing that Carl mentions in the book, like this was a well-known thing that this almost happened. Yeah. It leaked before the draft. It was talked about on KJR. I vividly remember one of my vivid Sonics memories is sitting at the Safeway in SeaTac listening. Well, probably our mom was in there shopping, listening to KJR, and all these people calling in and saying, oh, this is a terrible trade. Why would the Sonics ever do this? And you know who else was listening? The Barry Ackerley, the owner of the Sonics, as well as the owner of KJR at the time. And he was the one who squashed the deal.
He was swung by that?
Oh, yeah.
Wow, he reminds me of a particular politician who pays attention to the media.
But what Carl adds in the book is that when they were considering this trade, so at this point, Bob Whitsitt, who was the Sonics GM for many years, drafted Kemp, drafted Payton, put the team together, had been fired by Barry Ackerley.
Maybe drafted Sean Alexander.
Sean Alexander?
Wasn't he the...
Oh, yeah, yeah. I guess he might have. I don't know what the timeline was on that. I don't think so, though. He probably would have drafted Walter Jones. He was involved at that point. And Sean Springs. So he was fired by Barry Ackerley. There was kind of a power vacuum. Carl was sort of running the team. But then they also had Wally Walker come in as a consultant for the draft. And then he would eventually get the GM job after the draft. And so Carl was negotiating with teams, Wally was negotiating with teams, and it was a bit chaotic. This is part of why this all happened. Yes. But part of what George did in his reconnaissance is he calls up Michael Jordan, who's part of the North Carolina alumni family, is his George Carl, and asks him, hey, what do you think about this trade? And he relates in the book that Jordan told him, you should make this trade because Scottie Pippen will make his teammates better and Kemp can't.
Wait, what?
Yeah. Which is amazing because it suggests that like either Jordan didn't like Pippen as much as he said to Carl and secretly wanted this trade to go down, or he didn't know that he was going to come back the next season because this was during his retirement.
He didn't know that he was going to come back.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you believe...
Definitely Jordan's not answering honestly if he's playing at the time.
I don't think Carl would have called him if he was playing.
if you believe in the... no one has brought up this angle, actually. I probably should save this for ESPN at some point, but...
This is a more important podcast, let me just say.
If you believe the conspiracy theory that David Stern suspended Michael Jordan for a year and a half for gambling, this story directly contradicts that notion, unless he secretly just wanted to play with Sean Kemp. Because he answered as if he wasn't going to be playing with Scottie Pippen anymore.
Okay.
So that's why I think it's quite fascinating. But anyway.
Interesting.
Anyway,
so he tells George Karl that he should make the trade.
And that's one of the great what-ifs of NBA history, because obviously they go on to meet 2 years later in the NBA Finals with Pippen on the Bulls and Kemp on the Sonics.
Mm-hmm. In a series that we all know that if Nate McMillan was healthy, the Sonics would have easily won.
We'll talk about that another day. But what's interesting, so it's a fascinating what-if, because the Sonics would have traded for Pippen. They would have moved Detlef Schrempf to power forward, would have had a really small, very modern NBA
team. Oh, it kills me.
I don't know. I mean,
I don't care about Scottie Pippen at all, and Sean Kemp is probably the athlete that I care about the most of all time, after maybe Gary Payton and Ken Griffey Jr., so it's hard to really imagine this, but the idea of Detlef playing power forward sounds so good.
I mean, I think it sounds better to us now than it would have sounded in 1996 when he would have said defensive rebounding. Post defense.
I like the idea of, like, it was Irvin Johnson down low too, and Sam Perkins. Yeah. Like, they would have not rebounded.
I mean, we would have been such a modern team, though, in 1995. It would have been hard to imagine. The story that I've heard from Molly Walker is that the trade he was trying to make with the number 10 pick was...
There's another rival trade?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was trying to trade the number 10 pick and Kendall Gill, who was unhappy playing under Carl at the time.
My favorite player at the time.
Yeah, you share a birthday. To Sacramento for Mitch Richmond, which would have given the Sonics...
They were always in talks to get Mitch Richmond.
Two Hall of Famers in the backcourt. They would have a backcourt of Peyton and Kemp with Schrempf, Kemp. Peyton and Richmond.
It's probably like Roy Walker had a conversation about this. He called them with the idea. They were like, nah.
I don't know him as the kind of person to exaggerate this sort of thing.
And he's like, yeah, we almost got him.
But Carl ended up trading that pick and he traded that pick and Ricky Pierce to Golden State for Sharunas Marshalonis and Byron Houston. And the irony of this is Carl executed the trade and then hated Sharunas Marshalonis and, like, refused to play him the entire next season. And then subsequently, the Sonics were able to save that by trading Marshalonis and Houston to Sacramento for Frank Perkowski, an indispensable member of the 96 finals team, but still a really poor use of that number 10 pick.
How was Sharunas Marshalonis, by the way, statistically? When you look back...
By that point, he was not very good.
He was pretty bad?
He was strong in his early Golden State days, but he had torn his ACL, I think, for the second time before he came to Seattle.
Nice trade, George. So he made the trade basically as the GM of the team?
Yeah.
Really?
That's my understanding of it.
Oh my God. That's a really bad trade, by the way.
It's a horrible trade. I would have graded that very poorly if we were doing trade grades on ESPN Insider in 1994.
He traded the number 10 pick plus, wait, who else?
Ricky Pierce.
Plus Ricky Pierce. I mean, I don't know how good Ricky Pierce was at that
point. He was not very good at that point. Also, there was chemistry issues after he and Gary Payton threatened to pull guns on each other in the locker room during the series against the Denver Nuggets. But that's its own story for a separate day.
Who knows if they would have actually done it?
I mean, I've heard reports that they actually pulled guns. That's one of the rumors that are out there. Carl says just that they threatened to do so.
That it actually happened?
Yes.
Okay, sure. Okay. So you throw in Ricky Pierce, but even still, for the number 10 pick, getting Sharunas Marshalonis after two ACL injuries?
It might not have been his second, but that's my recollection off the top of my head. Anywho, is not the same player.
There's no other revelations in the book.
I mean,
this is George Karl's most successful tenure, and he has nothing to say about it.
No, I mean, he has lots to say about Seattle. It's just, like, weirdly not that controversial. Like, he says that he and Peyton butted heads at first, which we all knew, and that, you know, they had a meeting, I believe, at the Bellevue Pro Sports Club or somewhat thing like that, and kind of had, you know, they found a detente.
Change your number from number 2 to number 20.
That happened well before George Karl.
Okay.
And after that, he and Peyton got along very well. And obviously then in Milwaukee, he was an instrumental force in them trading
really
Ray Allen.
Really gave the Sonics a future.
He did. for Gary Payton. Ray Allen gets a beatie in the book.
What does he say about Ray Allen, by the way? How do you talk bad about Ray Allen? To me, Ray Allen is like he's like proto Russell Wilson.
It's weird because like in NBA circles, he's not as highly regarded. Like you saw the Rajon Rondo Instagram post a couple weeks ago, right?
Yeah.
Where he was talking shit about Dwayne Wade and Jimmy Butler. Mm-hmm. And so he was like, my veterans in Boston. Mm-hmm. And he showed, it was a photo of him and Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce and not Ray Allen.
Okay.
Because they hate Ray Allen so much.
They really hate Ray Allen?
I mean, really just because he went to Miami. Okay. Which, oh, how dare he? Mm-hmm. Like, that's pretty ridiculous stuff. But Carl, I think, you know, so he says that he thought that Ray valued his own stats more than winning and that he didn't play hard enough, especially in defense.
Maybe which is George not, Carl doesn't understand how important three-point shooting is.
He might not, which is not untrue, but I think it was mostly that George Carl is like such an animated personality that he can't understand the concept of someone being a reserve personality and also still wanting to win.
Wow.
So I think that's just
kind of... This kind of makes me hate George Carl even more because I really like Ray Allen.
Yeah, you side against Ray Allen, like you.
And also, shooting threes is basically the most important thing that you do. And he's like the. Is he still the leader in 3 points, three pointers in NBA history?
He is. Yes, I mean Steph Curry's obviously coming for him quite quickly, but he is.
But like Ray Allen invented Steph Curry.
I don't know if I would go that far.
Defense. It's just because George Carl only cares about players like Gerald Patio. Like
Vincent Askew?
Yeah. He really wants players who don't. I mean, sure, like I think maybe those players have a value in the modern NBA. But shooting threes is huge.
So I don't know. Other than that, he says that he told Sean Kemp to get a vasectomy.
Okay. That feels like a retronym to me. Like, okay, he had this huge story. You were a Kemp kid after all. But
I mean, I think he was more aware of the number of kids that Sean Kemp had than we were at the time. Yeah, I don't know. You know, he talks about kind of the rift with Wally Walker and that he was not in the loop on the Sean Kemp trade when they eventually traded him to Cleveland for Vin Baker.
Oh, really?
In that three-team trade. But that he was friends with Mike Fratello, who was the coach of the Cavaliers at the time, and Fratello was telling him all about the progress of the trade.
Really?
So then, like, Wally Walker came in to, like, tell them, oh, okay, break the news, like, we made this trade, and they already knew. But Wally's reason was he thought that George Carl would leak it all to the media, which probably is not an inaccurate thing.
He certainly would have. How do we think about that trade looking back on it, by the way?
I mean, it'd be interesting to look at it at the time. I think from the perspective of advanced stats, Vin Baker...
What would your trade grades have been for each team?
From the perspective of advanced stats, Vin Baker doesn't look as good now as he would have then, but it's kind of hard to like enforce that standard on them at the time. Like, like from that standpoint, he was an all-star who was similar in age. It like seemed like a reasonable deal because you also were getting rid of the headache of everything Sean Kemp had off the court. So,
but George Carl was a Sean Kemp guy.
He doesn't dislike Sean Kemp. No, I mean like he
doesn't dislike anybody from the Seattle era because he hates Ray Allen from Milwaukee, not from Seattle.
Right. Yeah. No, they never worked together in Seattle. I mean, pretty much just Carl. You know, he kind of skates around Barry Ackerley a little bit, but sided with Whitsitt in their feud.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't understand that very accurately. But yeah, had a billboard on our property on Queen Anne.
He doesn't. Apparently, people were upset. He suggests that people were upset in Seattle because Ackerley was cutting down trees that were blocking his billboards, which sounds vaguely familiar to me from the 90s and certainly sounds like a Seattle thing.
I love that 90s perspective. That's a good 90s take.
It really is. Yeah, I mean, he just doesn't say anything that interesting about his time in Seattle. I mean, there's a scouting report of the entire 95-96 Sonics, I think it was.
It's just randomly in there? He had a book around this time period, right?
Yeah, that's the funny thing. Is like, Carl, it's one of the things he's said in his interviews after this, including one he did with us on the NBA Lockdown podcast.
Oh, yeah, name dropping. Okay.
Is that...
If anybody really were to be on a Pelton cast, I would want it to be George Carl, and I would want it to be at Mecca. That would be so much fun if we could just get wasted with George Carl.
I don't think he gets to Mecca that much. I don't know if he drinks as much now that he's beaten cancer twice.
God.
But it's funny, he said
people
like
always give up on drinking.
He like talked about not understanding the book process and, you know, the way that things would be kind of quoted sometimes out of context when he when the book came out to the review copies,
And he's already written a book, which that was the confusing part. Like, obviously,
he forgot about it. This look, he's social up on drinking since then, but look, like he was drinking then.
Blogs and Twitter did not exist in 1996 when he dropped "This Game's the Best," so why don't they quit screwing with it? Or either late 96 or early 97. But he has written a book before, and it was a lot tamer. So
it was a lot tamer. I remember he proposed the idea of a mid-season tournament, right?
He did. It was very influential on my interest in such a thing.
In a mid-season tournament?
Yeah.
I'm kind of into that idea, too.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if there was anything else about his Seattle tenure.
It's really kind of amazing that this was his most important job of his entire career.
And he talks about it a lot in the book. But again, like I said, his memories are mostly fond of it.
Do you think it's just far enough away, or that it was just he was successful here?
And I think the fact that like he didn't clash with the superstars in the same way. Like, the guys who parted on bad terms were Vincent Askew and Irvin Johnson. Like, you're not going to devote a lot
of... He clashed with Vincent Askew.
Yeah, in the 96...
He's such a George Karl guy.
In the 96 finals. And, like, the story that no one ever talks about... Like, we're getting way too far into the weeds on Sonic's history here.
No,
we should
we're
be saving this
not.
All for my book, but...
Okay,
like,
this is what the podcast is about.
As much as everyone complains about the Jim McElvain contract...
Uh-huh.
The reason it
I'm
happened
like hanging on the edge of my seat for this Jim McElvain take
is because Irvin Johnson got upset about his playing time in the finals.
Okay.
And both he and Vincent Askew.
Irvin Johnson think he is? Wasn't he a second round pick, if that?
He was a first round pick, number 23 overall.
Okay.
So,
out of where?
New Orleans. So both he
Wait,
and
is New Orleans still New Orleans?
I think so.
It's just New Orleans College. Yeah. Okay.
University of New Orleans. At some point, at points during the finals, I'm pretty sure Askew missed a practice or like something like that. It was something that serious,
what
and that's why
he
got benched.
What did he have that was more important than going to practice?
He was upset about his playing time.
So he just didn't go? Dude, you're Vincent Askew.
I don't know why you're arguing to me about this. I'm not Vincent Askew. I'm not George Karl. Don't argue.
Like, you might have been quoted on the, like, the...
You're also taking George Karl's side on this, by
the
way.
The...
Yeah, you started
on our
with
phone message for our answering machine in 1996, but you're still Vincent Askew.
And then Johnson, it was something similar like that, where they had a falling out during the finals. So the Sonics couldn't re-sign Irvin Johnson to be their center. They needed to go out and get someone else to play 12 minutes a game and then defend Shaq.
And then get paid more than Sean
so
Kemp.
The way it worked is, if they had re-signed Irvin Johnson, at that point, like, you didn't, there wasn't the cap holds that exist now.
Uh-huh.
So you could just spend up to the cap and then re-sign your own players, which the Sonics did do with Peyton and I believe Hersey Hawkins that summer and maybe some other guys.
Okay.
But they couldn't do that with Johnson because of the fact that he couldn't play for George Karl anymore. So instead, they had to go out and sign a replacement center, and that was McElvain. And if they hadn't spent that money on McElvain, they weren't going to spend it on an extension for Sean Kemp. They were going to spend it on some other center. Like, it would have gone better because Jim McElvain wasn't good for the money they paid him.
Uh-huh.
But it was never that money was going to go to Sean Kemp. Only Sean Kemp thought that money was going to go to Sean Kemp. But if they had re-signed Irvin Johnson,
so
it might
have
gone
have
to Sean
paid,
Kemp.
Though? Okay, let's talk about an ideal world. I understand we're at like an hour and 45 minutes. Let's talk about an ideal world. Jim McElvain gets re-signed. When does Sean Kemp get paid his money?
It wouldn't have been until the Sonics had cap space again, because you have to have cap space to renegotiate
Never.
Someone's contract. And I don't think they would have the next summer, so it probably would have been after the lockout.
I mean, that's years after
and
that.
Even
he was
still,
already fab by that point.
And even still,
he was
you're
basically in Portland by then.
I mean, basically the situation, like, Kemp screwed up with his... He signed a bunch of bad extensions, as Scottie Pippen also did in Chicago.
Players from the 90s. I always think about rap music from the 90s, and I was trying to explain this to somebody. It's like, people don't, like...
It just wasn't professional.
Rap music from the 90s, people just did whatever. It's just like, here's a little bit of money, take it. And it's like, yeah, of course. And then I feel like around, like, Jay-Z time, like, Jay-Z came around, like, 98 or something, and was like, hey, by the way, I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman. And it's like, things changed. Right?
Yeah.
And it feels the same way with NBA stars. It's like the whole 90s is just like a lost era.
I mean, also the
it's
rules.
It's like you're dressing up like a grandma. It's like, this
oh,
is...
oh, how
okay,
dare
okay,
you
sorry.
Disrespect
grandma.
Like, very
like important moment. I probably guessed that right in the 90s cultural trivia that I got.
Really?
It made me take a shot from half court.
Really presaged Tyler Perry and that one Eddie Murphy movie, those Eddie Murphy movies that I can't.
That's really true.
But so basically what happened is like the rules make more sense now, but guys would just sign these like extremely long extensions that didn't account for the fact that the salary cap was going up so quickly. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden they'd look around and be like, hey, why are these other guys getting paid more than me? Well, because they got to free agency. They didn't sign these extremely long extensions. But the choice for a team like this,
David started cackling the whole time.
The choice for a team was, okay, well, we have some cap space now. Are we going to use it to go get some players who are going to make us better or extend this guy who's already under contract? Well, the choice you're always going to make is to sign new players.
But they don't have the win forever mentality, though. Like, the 90s was just a really bad era for long-term thinking, I feel.
I mean, if the Sonics had, like, left center position unfilled to extend Sean Kemp, people would have been really unhappy about that, too.
First off, Sean Kemp would have been an awesome center in the modern NBA.
Yeah, but we weren't in the modern NBA. We were in 1996, and you had to face Shaq in the Western Conference. So that was the one reason they legitimately did need a true center.
They needed to face Shaq? How did that work out?
It didn't work out super great. And I will maintain till my grave, besides the fact that the Sonics would have won the 96 finals if Nate McMillan had been healthy,
yes.
Which ignores
if GP would have defended Jordan early on.
Which it does come up in the book now.
Wait, what does he have to say about that?
So Peyton was dealing with like
this
a minor...
This is just us talking, but we're recording this, but this is... I have legit questions about
Peyton
this.
Was dealing with a minor injury, so that's part of why they didn't want him defending Jordan.
Who defended him?
Hawkins, I believe. Oh, God. Well, the funny thing is... Like much as everyone thinks of GP as a great defender, like a lot of the series comebacks in Sonic's playoff history happened when they switched Hawk onto the quick point guard.
Hot take alert, GP's a bad defender.
GP is an overrated defender.
Wow!
It's a true story.
You're so lucky this isn't an ESPN podcast for people to so that nobody can hear these words you're saying. You just said GP was an overrated defender.
But what GP was better at was defending bigger guards. So it did make sense for him to defend Jordan. But, like, he couldn't defend Stephon Marbury. And Tony Parker in 2002 just torched him.
Like, he was old by 2002.
He was
I think you're forgetting that poster. Which What was it with all the guards with the steals?
Yeah. GP, Kendall Gill, and Nate McMillan. Oh. The Sonics had, I believe, the second highest steal total in NBA history in 93-94.
Still, to this day?
I don't think it would have been broken. I can look it up here.
Okay, so he said GP had an injury during a minor injury.
Yeah, it was like a thigh injury or something. So that was part of why they did
it. But didn't things go much better? First off, who's a bigger guard than Michael Jordan?
No, I mean it makes sense for him to be on him.
Who was he defending in that series? Ron Harper?
He was probably defending Ron Harper. Yeah,
he was a pretty big guard, I suppose.
Yes.
Whew.
Where were we before then?
I don't even know. Something about Hersey Hawkins, I think.
Then
defense.
Well, trying to defend Shaq in the 97 playoffs. Okay, so the other thing I'll go to my grave believing is that Vin Baker's issue wasn't so much the lockout. It was how going against Shaq in the 97 Lakers series demoralized him.
He was like, I can't defend Shaq.
He also struggled to make free throws in that series, and then it became like a mental thing for him the next year.
Yeah, he got
shot like 50% from the free throw line. So those are things I will go to my grave believing.
Do you remember the next year we were watching a Lakers-Sonics game? We were like, for some reason, with David Pelton. Do you remember this? We were David Pelton at like some weird, like, we were at a condo maybe in Long Beach watching Lakers-Sonics in an early season game. That was during the lockout year. And Vin Baker just like, it was clear that Vin Baker was not the same person anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, that was very cool. Yes, that is still the second highest total in NBA history. The 77-78 Phoenix Suns had 1,059 steals. The Sonics had 1,053 in 93-94. No one else in NBA history has had at least 1,000 steals.
97-98 Phoenix Suns?
77-78.
Oh, that team.
Yeah.
I remember them. You know, Richard Dumas, so much promise.
Anything else on this book?
I really just want to talk. We're probably going to get offline. I'm going to talk to you about the Sonics for a lot more.
Oh, no. I like that you were going to go to bed like 2 hours ago.
Look, I mean, I don't sleep. Bring on the babies. I need to talk more about the Sonics. I'm for some reason, so desperate to have like just for the grind of an NBA team. I'm so desperate for it right now.
You're just really excited to have two games four games in 5 nights.
Watching the Pelicans earlier, and they won that game, and I was like, man, they just look like they don't even care about winning this game. It's like a Monday night after the Super Bowl. They look like they're like hungover. They don't care. But I'm just so desperate for NBA basketball. I think watching Lorenzo Romar, RIP, that watching Lorenzo Romar and watching these Huskies has really reminded me like how good it can be watching an NBA team and just going through that grind with them.
Well, you can have an NBA team. You can have the Celtics, who are coming to Portland this Thursday.
Are they really?
Going down to see Isaiah Thomas. And our cousin Katie will be there.
Is Katie going?
Yeah.
It's not the same. It's never the same. A team in Boston is not the same as a team in Seattle. I've always felt this. I always think this is about people who cheer for teams that are 1,000 miles away or whatever.
What if you move from the city you live in?
Even it's never the same if you can't see a team. If you can't see a team personally, it's never the same.
I suppose. Well, on that note.
We're going to talk a lot more about the Sonics. I have a lot of thoughts.
Oh, great.
You don't want to talk about the Sonics? What are you mad about? It's not like I'm saying we have to talk a lot more about...
I just want to go to sleep now.
All right.
All right. Thanks for listening.